I am Sea Dreams. My name is Christy Perez, Dr. Christy Perez. And for 10 years, I have been Sea Dreams, the advocate, litigator, organizer, journalist. I did all of that in prison. I've written pamphlets and I disseminated revolutionary material in the prison system. I didn't just get a contraband cell phone and watch Netflix.
Welcome. I'm Ben Boyce. This is the Dr. Junkie Show. And today, one of our longtime returning guests, Sea Dreams, or should I say Dr. Christina Perez, is coming back to talk about a whole bunch of new stuff and to explain what was going on with the audio in some of our previous episodes when it was scratchy or echoey, or sometimes we had a bad signal. Quick teaser for this episode, she just got out of prison after serving a long sentence. And for those that were listening, episodes 118, 123, and 124, where Sea Dreams was on before, were all recorded while she was incarcerated. So we'll talk about all that today. Since you already know her, I'll jump right into it. Welcome, Sea Dreams. So I noticed you're wearing an outfit that's new. I don't think I've seen you in that one before. Did you get some new clothes since the last time we met?
Definitely did. Yeah. So we got some regular clothes now. That's always nice to have.
I remember, I think every single episode we ended by saying something like, or I did, the audio was a little funky or there were some gaps that were hard to explain. We'll talk about all that later. There was at least one time when somebody walked into the room you were in and I just about was like, oh no, this is the end. Do you remember this?
I think I remember who it was. I think it was my roommate.
Yeah. Yeah. Where were you at?
So I was in prison. I was, I was locked up in prison. I was at Central State Prison. That's where I spent the past decade of my life doing my work as an advocate and a journalist, pursuing my education, which I don't have a PhD. I have a THD, which is a doctor of theology. They're considered the same academic level, but the THD is more seminarian rather than collegial. But yes, so I was incarcerated and I was using my time there to try to amplify the narratives and the voices of the underheard, because we talk very often about, you know, representing the marginalized and the vulnerable, and we talk about different forms of justice. But what's so crazy is the people who are often impacted the hardest by the legal system and the different forms of oppression are not given a voice. And I found that the media wasn't doing really good journalism when it came to the situations and the conditions of confinement of incarcerated people.
They're doing great journalism in the mainstream, but
yeah,
you're dead right. Like when it comes to the real story.
Well, I even disagree with the designation that they're doing mainstream journalism, because mainstream journalism to me is journalism in general is supposed to be about providing the facts in an unbiased minute. Well, you can't even say unbiased, because
I was going to say, bless your heart. No, it's not.
Journalism
it's supposed to look like what you're saying. It's supposed
it's
to appear.
Advocacy, and I've always said that my journalism is one of the
yours
most
is.
Potent forms of advocacy that I had. So
Fox News and MSNBC do not exist to, they exist to make you look and say, oh, this feels like they're really trying to be objective. No, their goal is to reinforce the status quo, which is why they describe us differently than we describe us. And you and I are more in what we might call this alternative media space, this new media that's trying to take some of the same positions and speak truth to power, for lack of a better term.
Exactly. And in their own way, they're in a form of advocacy too. They're just advocating from the opposite angle. They're advocating for narratives that maintain the status quo and keep the poor poor and keep people with substance issues in prisons rather than in treatment and with medical insurance. Narratives that make deviant people of alternative sexual expressions and gender expressions, those types of things. So they're invested in their own form of advocacy as well. It's just the advocacy is for the dark side.
And the special kind where you insist that it's the good. And it actually, from the right angle, when I'm watching my TV, it kind of feels like I'm on the good guys team no matter what I'm watching. That's the magic of media, is it's now owned by the capitalist billionaires who are also selling you Doritos and Nikes and everything else that tells you exactly what they're really trying to reinforce with the message. And if an anti-Nike ad or a story comes up and something terrible's going on and the news is going to run it, you better believe the owner of the company is going to say, number one, I own a whole bunch of Nike stock. Number two, they run ads on our station. I can't risk the revenue. And number three, who are we going to go talk to about the issue at Nike? Well, who's the professional? Call somebody at Nike. And then you interview them and you say, what happened at your factory, and expect them to give you an objective account, even though they work for the company. Mm-hmm. Journalism right now in the mainstream is, that's what I mean by good journalism. Our listeners yeah. can't see my finger quotes. It sucks. It has to conform to that. But you, I'll link again all your work, which has expanded quite a bit since we talked, but it is in this area that we don't really have a solid name for yet, but it's sort of this new area of journalism that is using technology to basically rise up and have the same appearance online as others.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. I think that the accessibility to tech and the way that it's revolutionized the ability to reach people through various platforms that are interest specific, like Filter is interest specific to people that are really interested in harm reduction and various. Harm reduction is their main bailiwick, but they also dabble a little bit in like policy and the carceral space and stuff like that. And that's something that I'm seeing more, by the way. I look at Filter magazine. Shout out to Castalia Madrano and Will Godfrey, the editors there. I look at them and I see that they are running more stories by prisoners. And, you know, nobody's tipped their hat at me, but I was the first Georgia prisoner to, I can't speak for other states. I was the first Georgia prisoner to become a journalist and using their platform primarily to get my start. But I look and I see all of these different prisoners' stories popping up on Filter. And I'm like, I started that trend.
I mean, to remind everybody, that's why I contacted you. I don't know if we quite mentioned that, but I bumped into some of your early work that was published there. And at the time, I had no idea to like wrap up why I started where we're starting. Why was our audio so bad? And to remind people, you were somehow working in the margins in a space that's not supposed to exist, navigating every barrier to speaking to the world, getting your voice outside. Activism from prison, good fucking luck. You had to literally break the rules and then I'm telling you, when your door opened, I was like, oh no, it's a CO and I'm going to be responsible for finally getting her parole is going to get jacked or something. Yeah. That was the position you got to be in. I've gone and looked at some of the work you were doing. And just to let everybody listening know, she's not saying like, oh, I wrote a couple articles. You had like two podcasts you managed to record and publish while you were in there. You had not just Filter, but you were publishing really regularly, publishing pretty hardcore research-based, showed that you had been reaching out to different sort resources, interviewing people, putting together actual data that's cited and hyperlinked in the article and getting it published in multiple sources. Like, fucking kudos.
Thank you so much. I look back and I feel three things about that situation. One, I feel a sense of gratitude to, you know, Christina of the past, who took the time, or should I say Sea Dreams? I am Sea Dreams. My name is Christy Perez, Dr. Christy Perez. And for 10 years, I have been Sea Dreams, the advocate, litigator, organizer, journalist. I did all of that in prison. And I've written pamphlets and I disseminated a revolutionary material in the prison system. And I had the opportunity to work with really awesome people while being incarcerated from outside. Even Janet Mock, who is, you know, producer, actress, and editor of People Magazine as well, or editor of People Magazine online. That was a huge thing for me. So I look back and I feel gratitude that I sacrificed and I took the time to do that stuff and that I didn't just get a contraband cell phone and watch Netflix. And for the people that are doing that in prison, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not knocking them at all, especially if you have a lot of time. You deserve whatever you can do to make the time more bearable. So I'm not knocking anybody, but I feel gratitude for that. And then the second thing I feel is I feel kind of an amazement, either A, that they never figured out who it was, or B, they knew who I was and they were just so fucking scared to fuck with me, they left me alone.
And it's probably both. This might be worth touching on while we're here. You did not make their lives easy. You had three lawsuits, one or two of which you represented your goddamn self in court. Yeah. And again, this is on top of all the stuff you're doing. And even if they would have had word of it, I think it's hard to talk to some students about this because you actually don't want to tell anybody, put your body on the line. It can get bad in prison real quick because they don't want anybody to get the leverage you have. But once you've got it, it's almost too late. And this process has started where I imagine if there were some whispers, they might have been like, just get her the fuck out of here. Send her on parole already.
Definitely think with my last lawsuit that I filed that we ended up having to toss because I got released from prison. So it made the complaint moot. I definitely think that's what happened because we got to the point where they had to settle or they had to go to trial, and out of nowhere, parole happened. And that's why I tell my friends who are still in the system, I tell them pressure is everything.
Yep.
Pressure cooks food, pressure makes diamonds, and pressure breaks down shit. So
I had a friend in the county 25 years ago who came out on road crew with us, and they didn't train us, but we would run chainsaws, and he slipped on the third or fourth day and like laid his arm open, and he opened. Mm-hmm. He was fine, but like 30 stitches. And what do you know? His whole 1 year sentence ended up being about 2.5 months. And one night they just came and got him. Pressure works in lots of different ways. And I don't think he did it deliberate, but he was a pretty clever guy from what I remember. So I wouldn't be surprised if he did. But
yeah, you're right.
That's a story almost all incarcerated people know, is that there's folks that just manage to get the lever at the exact right angle. But my God, mm-hmm. Your story. I do want to take some time today, if we can, to start where I feel like I should have the last three times, because we haven't yet, and talk about your story and where you came from, and maybe all the way up to where your prison empowerment started, because fuck, the beginning of your incarceration is nothing like whenever you started to get that wedge and then you built on it and made it more and more. Can you tell us a little bit about, I don't know where you want to start, maybe what was your early like life, since I'm big on free will right now in our criminal justice system and accountability, and we often forget to say what happens before someone's arrested.
Yeah, you've sent me some great books about free will.
Yeah, probably pissed you off at least once. Sam's hard.
No, I love the science because I'm a believer, but at the end of the day, I'm a scholar too. I love facts. Yeah. But and that's still, none of that negates what I still believe. If anything, exactly. I think that it better informs it. So yes, I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1990, but I never really grew up there. I grew up in Maryland, mostly in the state foster care system. My mother was brutally murdered in front of me by her boyfriend when I was about 4 years old, 5 years old. And my sister, she had been taken from us and went to live with her father when I was still like pretty much a baby. So I grew up in the care, air quotes, of the state foster care system called the Maryland Department of Social Services. And I was a really wild child. I had a lot of like trauma from like sexual abuse and everything. Like my mom was like not the most stable person. She was a sex worker and a partier, and I had a lot of love for different types of drugs. The harder, the better. As I was growing up, I didn't have any sense of roots. I was very dislocated from like structure, the way the system is set up, and also me complicating it because of how deviant, again, in air quotes, I was. I would get transferred a lot from group home to group home, foster care to foster care family. So I never really had any stability either. By the time I was like 13 or 14, I had been exposed to so much sexual predation, both as a very young child, but also like in the boys' homes, because even though I was born a boy my whole life, I have looked exactly like a female. The only thing that I ever added to my body was like the sex change itself. But even when I was like a little 12-year-old running the streets of Baltimore, people always thought I was a woman. I guess at that point, like I realized that sex had an economic valuation to it. And for a young person who is pretty much living in the streets and is getting acquainted with the gay world and with trans people who were my community and who helped me survive and provided for me, there was a whole like cadre of us, young queer people, disenfranchised. So I took the sex work to survive at a very young age, and I began to put myself in through transition. And so I would literally go to high school and then drop my stuff off at whatever foster home or group home I was in. I would sneak out or run away, spend the weekend doing my own thing in Baltimore with my friends or what have you. Fast forward, the state of Maryland kept trying to hospitalize me, kept trying to put me away because I was trying to transition, and I would run away. And so finally, when I was like 17 years old, I ran away for the last time because I found out that Georgia was... Well, back up. I knew that there were states that at 17 you were considered an adult and that you couldn't be sent back to your home state on an endangered youth warrant. So I met these two girls who worked with a company called Prestige Sales, which if you Google them, it's owned by Mark Tork and his brother, and they've got some shady complaints against them. Looking back, it was very shady. But pretty much it's this company that travels where the weather is warm following the season, and they do like door-to-door sales. They try to sell you like comic books, movies, stuff like that, okay? Anyway, I was with them for a few months. I stayed in different hotels and got to see some states. I'd never really been anywhere. But eventually they found out I wasn't 18, which you would have thought that a proper business would have tried to figure that out from the very beginning. And they found out that I had an endangered youth warrant on me. So when we were in New York, they were like, hey, we're so sorry. You got to go. You can't stay here. And I told them like my whole background story. And they were like, okay, well, we're not going to force you to go back to Maryland if you're saying that you're not safe there. Like, but we're buying you a bus ticket today. Here's the money. You go buy the bus ticket. You need to decide where you're going. We don't have any responsibility about any of that. So a girl that I had been friends with was recently terminated because her sales were bad and she was from Georgia. And so she was just like, well, if you ever want a chance to come see me, visit me. So literally I'm on the Greyhound bus and I call her and I was like, hey girl, you remember you told me to come see you in Georgia? I'm on the way. Do you have a couch by chance I could sleep on? So I get to Georgia. It's like July or August of 2008. And I always had back in the day this ability to find friends from like the rebels and the miscreant. So very quickly I rebuilt that community. I had bills to pay and I wasn't 18. And the only jobs I could get were like minimum wage jobs. And I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to go. The person that I was at that time wasn't going to do like I do now. Wasn't going to go work a job that they hated. But also, like, I was trying to build, I wanted to be a drag entertainer at that time. And so I wanted to be some type of entertainer, some type of personality. I really wanted to be a TV or a radio personality. And so I was like doing drag and I was doing like party promotions and I was doing like beauty pageants. I was doing like anything that could get me attention, basically. I had an issue with that. I don't have that anymore, thank God.
Now you get all the attention and you don't have the issue.
No, I don't need the hollow praise. Just give me the paycheck because I got to keep my lights on. And that's a different thing we'll talk about in a minute.
But we're going to get to that for sure.
These organizations are some bullshit out here. And I will call them out.
Atlanta's hard for sure. I mean, everywhere in the South is hard.
So a couple years pass and I'm slowly kind of building my name. I'm like on every party scene in Atlanta. Involved with Pride, all types of stuff. And I had a different name at that time, which I will not tell. The mainstream media, Fox 5, et cetera, wrote about my case. And even a few gay outlets, I was surprised to find out, wrote about my case and just decided to literally copy paste what the major, like Fox 5, Atlanta 5 wrote.
Yeah. So what actually happened?
So long story short is we all lived in this house. It was like that house of ultimate ill repute.
There was I knew drugs, it. I've been there.
Drugs, sex, partying almost every night, you know? And so it was a weird situation. It was the landlord with his ex-wife and her boyfriend. And it was a big ass house. It was beautiful, had a bunch of different rooms in it, but it was like always dirty because it was like we'd just party and fuck it up. But this person began to like apply pressure and really force a bunch of us to, which we were already kind of like casually doing sex work, but we weren't like turning out quotas. We were kind of just doing it whenever we had to hit a lick, we needed to get some dope, or it was time to pay for our hormones or something like that. Like it was supplementary income is what it was.
Maybe we should mention the alternatives too, because I just got out of prison. But if we roll the clock back 5 years and then map those areas of our life on top of each other, I was in the same position. And guess what decision I was making? I was waiting until it was night and stealing shit out of your car and like taking your rims off and selling them at the pawn shop the next day and going through your shed and taking the tools that you need to work your full-time job.
That was you?
There's more. I'd have to think a little bit. I had a foggy memory for a couple of years, but you actually have more stigma for your crime than I do. I'm pointing on you on the Zoom thing because you're over there. But you're somehow still in our culture today. there's something more danger, stay away with you. And I was like, I was trying to count them up the other day. I think I've had something like a total of 91 felony charges total. And of course, when you get 15, they get reduced to one to three, depending on what the charges are. And with me, it was over and over massive amounts, got the white boy discount where I was like, I'll just plead out and do probation.
The white boy discount. I love that. I've never heard that before. The white boy discount.
It only works in court.
I love that. I'm going to steal that.
Yeah. So anyway, you make this decision to do sex work. So it sounds like you're in Atlanta. Clearly everything in our minds was going great for you. And now we have to rethink like, oh wait, this was a position where you're like, bills got to be paid. I have what you might think of as Jean Valjean's hunger for bread, an addiction that when you get up in the morning feels the exact same way in real time. Like I need this thing today and I have to do something to get it. I'm making the decision to rob old ladies. You're making the decision to actually sell sex, which is the oldest profession in the world, but still criminalized everywhere. How did it go for you?
Well, it was good until the person that was a landlord became like really aggressive, and he started kind of like trying to almost insinuate himself as like a pimp. Basically, we ended up being pressured to do more sex work, so it was a form of trafficking. That's not to say that we weren't already in that, but I had been trafficked as a teenager for a short period, kind of against my will. So there was kind of a lot of similarity in like this power dynamic. But also when you are very young and this person is much older, because I was 19 at this time, and this person much older, and this person has done favors for you and provided you housing when you had nowhere to live. And on top of that, you have a drug addiction. I was doing cocaine and crack regularly.
It's good. So it's good stuff.
I don't want to go back, but
no. Well, we got other drugs now.
Time. I will say that we had a good time.
Yep. We just got better drugs now that you and I have found along the way that were like, oh, more sustainable, easier to get without spending as much money.
My drug now is shoes. And I vape a little bit. Like, that's my drugs.
Yeah, your drug is learning and teaching, though. My hope, is that
you get off. I do love doing that, too.
Interview and feel like, oh, okay, I got a little bit high. After I walk out of a class, I got half a shot of heroin in my vein. It's great. And I can't fail a drug test if I have to take one. Not that I care.
Well, that's one of the great things is I've actually been given permission to, I can't go wild. But I can have like in a family or a event setting, a drink or two. So that is nice because that kind of normalizes everything. But long story short, this guy that was putting on this pressure, he was like a convicted real. He had been convicted before and really had offenses against a minor. And you know that I am a person who speaks for sex offense reform, registration of the reform. And for the humanization of all people that have any type of criminal record, okay? But this person had moved from Illinois to Georgia, and we knew that he had boyfriends. Like, we knew his boyfriends were young. Like, we did. But also, the world that I am from, the world that I grew up in, I had been 15 or 16 with boyfriends in their 20s and 30s. And I definitely had Johns in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. We came from a different world. And a lot of these people today who are judging my situation and the situation of other people like me, they're looking at it from a very upper middle class, white, conservative perspective. But bitch, you've never had to suck dick to put meals in your fridge. Okay. You never had to do that. So don't judge me. I'm sorry. So
I agree. You see me over here like, yeah, preach it.
I do. But the reality is a lot of us had no home to go to. We had nobody to turn to help us. We were literally in the world by ourselves and with the sense of community that we built. And we had been that way since some of us were 10, 11, 12 years old. My friend Ronnie had literally been homeless since his stepfather put him out of the house because he was like, you know what? You're going to grow up to be a faggot. And he happened to be right. But he could see that in his son, Ronnie, already, which I love Ronnie. I love the fact.
It feels so much safer to go out with gay friends.
And I want to say for all your viewers and all your listeners, because I know there are some people out there that are super, I am an old school tranny. Okay. I started transitioning literally when I was like 12, 13 years old. I am an OG, original gangster. As me and my girlfriend Aubrey call it, we call it original cock gobblers, OCGs. But I am an OG tranny. I am not one of the sensitive new generation of like, the, and I don't offend anybody. I love everybody, but I don't understand a lot of the stuff that is in the LGBTQ XYZG community. There's a lot of letters. I don't even understand all the letters. I love everybody. I feel like you should do what you want to do, dress how you want to dress, change what you want to change about yourself, pursue your own happiness. But I will say that I am not one of the more tender, new-aged queer people. So don't get offended. Also,
that's the world we grew up in. I mean, I think that's a weird, benefit's the wrong word, but it is the silver lining that you and I both have, that when you grow up in a world, by the way, those fuckers are still there. They've just learned to shut the fuck up and go over to 4chan and say it to each other instead of getting butchered on Twitter, or they still do and they just don't care. But when you grow up in that and then you see the changes to where we're at, you just nailed it. We're not only like, oh, thank God we're trying. We're now like, let's not try the wrong direction, or
we're trying too much.
Exactly.
I was at an event and I said, I came out and I was like, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Hello to all you faggots and trannies. I love you. Now, I'm a known trans woman. I'm a known trans activist and journalist. Yes. It's on my page. It says, yes. Christy Perez, also better known as Sea Dreams. It's a transsexual, blah, 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 blah. I represent my people, but I'm from a different generation where we could say that. I said that now, and my own people are like, oh my God.
They don't get reappropriation. You're on the Dr. Junkie show right now, and if you're a square that comes on this show and has never smoked a joint in your life, and you start saying, well, junkie's this and junkie's that, it comes out of your mouth and does different things in the universe than when it comes out of my mouth, because we're junkies. Exactly. We are reappropriating a word that everybody knows what the fuck that word's used to do. Me using it doesn't make it worse. It takes just a little bit of the, it's like taking a knife and just hitting it on the fucking concrete one time. Assholes are still going to use the language to put me in my place, fine, but the next time they use it, they've got to have it edged off a little bit. They can't slice me and the rest of my people quite as deep. That's something that, I mean, just to add a specific point to what you're saying, when we say it's gone too far in some areas, here's one great example of where, like, if we lose the recognition of how powerful reappropriation can be in venues where there is no other way to take power back, language is like deadlocked when it's in a small group of white guys in the bar and nobody else is within earshot. It does what it fucking does. You got to change it the next day on TV or on the radio or when you talk to them.
The queer folks who were more OG than I am, the generation before my generation and the generation before their generation that began like the Stonewall riots and all the protests and the real fight to advance our humanity in the public sphere. You know, they said these words. They took these words as being powerful, and they took these words as a part of our expression and our language. So I just want to say that little bit so that nobody gets offended by me. If you do get offended by me, I'll send you a box of tissues. I can afford to buy them now from off the commissary, so you'll get some good soft tissues.
Nice, not the face rubbers.
So long story short, we got busted because this guy promised his boyfriend, like, when you graduate from high school, I'm going to buy you a car. So boyfriend graduated from high school and he didn't cough up the car. So the boyfriend was like, I got your number. I'm going to go home to my family and tell them that you've been fucking me for the last 2 years. Okay. So that's what happened. It drew police attention. The police showed up. They started looking into the situation of that case. And before long, they found out like all of us were a bunch of miscreants. We were all a bunch of party kids, ballroom scene kids, drag kids, drug users, good time banjis. That was us. So we got busted. And a girl who was my really good friend, she had in some ways, similarities to my story. I considered my sister. She turned out to be 17. I got dragged into it, which the reality is I don't think that I was sober enough back then to ever ask her age. And it didn't matter. That was not a conversation that existed in my world. Like, oh girl, before we go suck this cock, how old are you?
Right.
No, it was like, girl, let's go get this coin so that we can get high and make sure that we pay the car note today. You got to handle business and pleasure. All right. That was the perspective. That was the mindset.
The sum total of who Christina was at that point in her life, exactly, only from her genetics plus the experiences she had been through. The five of which you've shared with the listeners so far are enough, and there's a million more to make us go, oh shit, your programming was much different than my programming. When you are in that world at 15 and people have dumped you in it at 15 and you haven't yet even recognized that you being in it, you were at that moment and before already, you were seeing the world very differently. Shit, she's 2 years older than I was. What's the difference? Or this person's 2 years older than I was.
She was 2 years younger than I was.
Younger than Yeah, but older than you were when you were 3 years, oh, when yeah, you were dragged into the same world. How can people not expect you to do that now?
Because that was something we were accused of. She was not dragged in. Even the prosecutors had to admit that there were posts that she was making online on Craigslist during a time that they stipulated and agreed that I was not even in Georgia yet. They tried to accuse me of sophisticating her craft, making her, I'm sorry that I helped her do it better and make more money.
How could they pull that off? Do you have some sort of identity where like there's already some sort of stigma and stereotype publicly attached that maybe there's a corruption of children?
Definitely was. They called me Atlanta drag queen, the XYZ, all this stuff like that. But what people don't realize is that I was being sexually abused from a young age and I was being trafficked. So I saw sex work as being able to control something that people had already been taking from me for years, which was access to my body, and being able to economize it, being able to generate revenue off of it. When I tell people that I was literally in the streets, I had been homeless for a large portion of my life, sleeping on friends' couches. And sometimes when their parents would put me out, because I've been there too long, I would sleep in their bushes because at least it was safer than other areas. And I have been doing this literally since 12 or 13 years old.
Just to make sure everybody listening, I'm sure most of them have picked it up, but do you still feel that way now?
No, because people change and we are a product of our genetics and our experiences. But the reality is I took steps. I made decisions and I utilized every opportunity that was presented to me. And some of those were not, and I want to be clear that none of those opportunities were given to me by the prison system. I generated those opportunities through the grace of God and through my own hard work and the receptivity of people who I encountered to be able to build a side career and whatnot. But I want to be clear, if I was not a married woman and I was without a job and I had to pay, for example, to keep my freedom because I'm on parole, I would do whatever I needed to do to make sure I stayed. The difference is I don't have a drug addiction now, so I could actually responsibly use all that money. I will do whatever it takes. I am never going to suffer deprivation again in my life. I'm never going to put myself in the position where I can't feed myself. I can't keep myself warm or cool or clothed. Or more importantly, I can't maintain my liberty. Right. But thankfully, the situation I have now is different. However, I frequently think about people who are returning to the world and basically their former circumstances from prison that don't have the opportunities I have. And I want to be clear, my life is not peachy. I work 50 hours a week in a manufacturer as a quality control inspector. And I'm a fucking princess. I do not like manual labor.
You are a princess. That's well said.
I am a fucking princess. Well, I am so like girly and finicky. By the way, I have a new professional photo that I want you to use for this podcast. Everybody can see how pretty I am.
I think I already saw it. Yeah, I thought you were somebody that was like in charge of a class I was getting ready to take. I was intimidated.
Well, you know, I just gave my first college lecture at Emory like 2 weeks ago.
I should have you come talk to one of my classes sometime if you're down.
I would love to. I've never been to Colorado. I'll come.
Yeah. Oh, you can do it in person. We could just Zoom you in someday, probably.
Oh my God, let's do it.
It's really hard to do the in-prison classes. Otherwise, that'd be fun to do. But I do like this. I think
we could totally do the Zoom. Yeah. I'm all for that. That way I can wear a t-shirt like I am right now.
Yep. So to sum up the beginning of our conversation, 45 minutes in, you're arrested for a few charges that are related to sex work, which means a number of things. Number one, all this stigma shows up and you get this massive sentence, but also, as we'll talk about in a sec, your parole is going to be in your life for the rest of your life is going to be quite a bit different than the average person that walks out of prison. So what were the charges and the sentence?
So to encapsulate it, I was originally charged with like 4 or 6 counts of human trafficking. Like legit human trafficking, like Homeland Security, the anti-human trafficking task force showed up with the sheriff's department and like a inter-agency thingy going on there. And that sounded very doctoral, didn't it? I was blown away. I could not believe the situation I was in. And it seemed so disproportionate and so surreal that for the longest time, I was actually convinced that I wasn't going to get convicted. I was like, no, this type of shit doesn't happen to me. I can't even show up in time to get the special at McDonald's when they're running those little promotions. So I know that I'm not important enough for this to be happening to me. And like, I will never forget this little short, adorable Asian lady. She was like 5'4" with this blazer that was too big for her by several sizes. And on the back was emblazoned Homeland Security. And I was like, there is no way. There's no way. So they, this dickhead deputy, I wish I could remember his freaking name.
They're all dickheads. I won't get in trouble. They're not all dickheads. Only 95% of them are dickheads. I said
this dickhead deputy. I'm specifying.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, I'm specifying he was. But to be clear, ACAB, in my opinion, ACAB. for anybody that doesn't know what ACAB is, it means all cops are bastards. But yeah,
I think everybody knows 1312.
I hope so.
I think that's what it is. ACAB, all cops are bastards. Yeah. So if you ever see 1312 on a wall, it means ACAB.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I we've let our audience on some slang for the day. You're welcome. We're young.
Yeah. We're giving out education here.
We're young now. We're branded into the millennial and younger generation.
What are you talking about? I'm still young. I'm 33. I just realized I'm going to be 34 this year. I'm depressed.
That's why I know you. I can be like, well, I know a young person.
But yeah, so I got, I pled out to pimping of a minor, less than 18 years of age, but greater than 16 years of age, which is a really complicated way of saying that my minor was 17, but that's the subsection of the pimping statute I fell under. So I pled out to pimping of a minor and to pandering of a minor and exploitation of a minor in place of the human trafficking charges, because the human trafficking charges each carried like a 25 sentence. So I would have ended up with like a couple hundred year sentences. I sat in county jail for 2 years trying to fight my charges. And in, I want to say April or May of 2012, I finally pled guilty for conduct that I was charged for that occurred when I was 19, because the period of time that they charged me for on the indictment and the warrants was during a time that it was all the way up till September of 2010, which is when I was 19 years old. They took me into custody in early 2011. And I sat in jail for almost exactly 2 years before I pled out. I'm sorry, not 2011, 2010. Or yes, in 2010. In other words, that conduct would have occurred in 2009 then, I think. I might have my dates a little off. Yeah. So I sat for two years trying to fight it. And I had this public defender. And I know a lot of public defenders get bad like raps, like public defenders are lazy or whatever. And I will say the public defenders are definitely overworked and the good ones are underappreciated. But this woman, Allison Frutos, had actually been like some type of junior or student attorney on the first OJ case in California. Most of her legal experience was from California and she was very open-minded. She was from California. So I got lucky that the fact that I was in a very conservative district, a good old boy, small system where the same two families have been mayor, county commissioner, and chief superior court judge for like the last 50 years, the same like two or three families, the Camps, the Pounds, and the Lees.
They don't sound racist.
Yeah. Well, the Pounds are actually mostly a black family. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. I'll take
they're,
it.
They're definitely simps for the power system.
I was going to say, they can still be racist. We can take a whole episode and talk about how that works if you want.
I definitely know about that. As a mixed woman who is Hispanic, black and white, I have been the victim of colorism my whole life.
Yeah, I heard some people in a recent podcast stumble through colorism with you. I think you said something like what you just said, and they said, can you tell us what you mean about the color, the whatever you just
colorism?
Said? Yeah, well, no, that's how they said it. They were like, whatever you just said, that's a term that I think critically started to show up 10 years ago, and then it kind of fizzled out before we really fully pulled it apart. But we should schedule that for another podcast.
We should, my God,
every time we talk, we got chemistry, and we just sit here and yak for an extra hour, and it turns into a podcast. I got to split in half.
Yeah, we like an unregulated itinerary.
That's me.
So I ended up getting a 30-year sentence with 14 to serve in custody. The first time they tried to give me parole, it was violated within less than a month because I could not afford, and I was trying to do things the clean way, I could not afford to pay my bills and pay all of the costs that parole had put on me with like the ankle monitor that ran me like $250 a month. The drug test, they were charging me $25 or $50 every pop, and I was getting them like twice a week for real. all types of classes they wanted me to take. So it was just like, basically, I ended up getting a second job that was, because I have to register as a sex offender for literally selling my own ass and for being involved in the business with somebody else who was a trans woman and who had been doing this for years. I now have to register for 10 years. I basically got a job that was 947 feet from a church. It was at an animal hospital I was working. This was my second job. I'm required to work and live 1,000 feet from a church, a school, a park, a pool, et cetera.
This or place more. You cannot go, if I understand right, you're not even supposed to, unless you're driving by and not stopping, you're not even supposed to go within 1,000 feet, right? Or is it live?
Well, other people's conditions may be different. Okay. I don't know. I'm allowed to, when I'm not on parole, I'm allowed to go anywhere I want. The parole conditions for me are actually more stringent than the conditions that I have to abide by when I come off of parole, which I come off parole March of 2025. So about a year from now, I'll have basic probation for about, I actually technically will have 16 years of probation, but a law that was passed a few years ago here in Georgia makes every felon eligible for early termination of their supervision after 3 years, provided all of their fees and stuff are paid. I've completely paid my restitution, so I don't owe the state of Georgia anything except for that 3 years. And then I'm going to hire an attorney and I'm going to go ahead and get my stuff terminated early. I might do it myself just to show that I can.
Yeah, but, yeah, I like it. But we're still back to flag it as we're going by a system that's designed to look like it's equal and that it's the Lady it's Liberty holding a blindfolded justice. It and if you got money, trust me, you're going to
ever. And it's still crazy.
It's still fucking with you because I'm glad we've arrived here. You 16 years is what they were sentencing. You get out of prison and now you got to spend 16 or 17 years checking with somebody who, if you have a bad night and cuss somebody out and almost get arrested, technically you just violated. You might go back to prison and have to do
the rest of your sentence. Yeah, you had police contact. Yeah, police contact.
Anything like that. And so it's worth us talking a little bit more. You mentioned, even before you got out in one of your recent articles, you have to have approved housing. You can't just get out and wing it. And this rule already applies. So you have to show them where you could stay. Did you have a house set up that ever got not approved before you got out? Or did the first one you...
So I literally went through 14 addresses, 4 of them out of state and the 10 of them in Georgia. And every single one was denied for proximity to a church, a school, a pool, a public park, something like that. The only real support system I had was in New York. It's my good friend, Castalia Madrano, who's like a sister to me. We don't get to talk as much as I would like to because she's married. I'm married. She lives on the other side of the country now because her husband is incarcerated in Washington. My good friend, Castalia, and my other good friend, journalist and advocate, Seshi Blanchard, they had created like a little network for me and they were going to take responsibility for housing and help me get a job and put me up so that I could get stable. And they were also helping to raise funds for my reentry to make it a little easier. So that option was deprived. It was taken away from me. So I spent months and months and months basically making calls and trying to find housing. I was even like emailing people on Craigslist randomly and like that were like advertising rooms for rent and like telling them my situation and hoping that they were going to be reasonable, empathetic human being.
Just to be clear, reasonable, empathetic, meaning I'm a homeowner that actually has an extra property that means at some point I've done something somewhat well in my life. And instead of being forced to sell it, I was like, I'll just use it to invest more money and eventually I'll own it. It'll be a great investment. Always retains value. I need to rent it to somebody and you have to show up and say, okay, here's the deal. Number one, it's not within 1,000 feet, which is a long, it's not that close. That's like a fifth of, this is 20% of a mile. That's a long distance. If it's anywhere near these four places, let me know. Or if there's ever going to be any kids on the property, is something else you mentioned that you actually found a place that would work. And then the third thing is that you found somebody who you actually could talk through the biggest hurdle to me, the stigma of, okay, by the way, here's my situation. I have to sign the sex offender registry every year. Do you mind if I rent your house? And every stereotype that is packed into Americans' minds shows up in their mind and they're like, oh God, what's going to happen at that house? How do you even find somebody that'll rent? And then what happened? You mentioned at least one story. What sometimes happens when you do find somebody that's willing to rent to you? How simple can it be to totally make that impossible?
Basically, everything has to be approved by it has to be approved by the parole board before you get out, because you're being released on an early privilege. So they want to make sure that you're not going to become a burden, or that you're not going to return to some type of criminal pattern. So they want to make sure that you have, it has to already have everything set up in your name, the lights, the power, everything. So you have to pay the rent in advance while you wait for the parole board to actually say, okay, because before you had an offer of parole, then you have to come in response to the offer of parole and show an employment plan and a housing plan. So you have to get this place, pay the deposit, pay rent for probably a month or two or three. You have to have everything on and in your name. So that's more money that you have to have. And you've got to submit this to the parole board, and it can take them a week. It can take them 3 or 4 months before they finalize the decision and say, okay, your parole is granted, you can go. So you're talking about basically 1% of prisoners, people incarcerated, that can actually afford to do that in that situation. If they don't have their own independent income from, or independent money from before they were incarcerated, or if they don't have a well-resourced family, a well-off family to make this happen, it's impossible. Because, yeah, I have a good friend of mine. His name is Gus. He's been in prison for 30 years, okay? And for 35 years. And he's eligible for parole. They've tried to give it to him several times. He's not a person that has been charged with a sexually related offense. Yeah, he doesn't have to contend with the 1,000-foot rule or anything like that, but it's still impossible for him. Almost everybody that he knew has passed away, yeah. All right? The man's in his late 60s. So he has no type of support whatsoever. And I think about his situation almost every day. I think about the situations of people just like him. The reality is Georgia will tell you, oh, well, we have halfway house and we have transitional centers. But as you know, I've written stories that senior citizens and people with any type of health issue are usually denied placement at the TCs. And therefore, they're precluded the opportunity to ever again have a chance to live.
And what do those cost? Those aren't free, right?
No, they're not. You have to work while you're there, which is great. That's what a lot of these people want to do. They want to get out. They want to get a job. They want to have that little bit of independence and freedom. They want to save money and be able to go out and restart their lives. So, of course, you have to pay for transportation, and you have to pay room and board at these programs.
But what you're talking about, $100 a month?
It's about $100 a week. About $100 out of each paycheck is how it goes. And it's like $50 per week for your transportation. What Georgia Dussel doesn't tell you is that it only has 1,300 TC beds, and like 300 of those are for women. So they only have like 1,000 beds in a prison system that houses anywhere between 50 and 70,000 prisoners at any given time. I spent months trying to do this, and finally I had a tip off from an old acquaintance of mine who also previously been incarcerated about this great guy in the LaGrange, Georgia area that, you know, he had houses and he specifically set them up as programs and had approval through the state, and all the houses were suitable, but they were like group living situations. So I called out some favors on friends, put together money, and pulled from the funds, the reentry funds that they had begun putting together for me, just hoping that the parole board, but I also had a good feeling they were going to grant my parole very quickly, because as you know, we talked about, I've sued them so much, and I am a ferocious advocate for myself, but I also had outside help too, to help me harass the system. So when you pissed me off, you got a couple hundred emails and a couple hundred phone calls in the span of a few hours. And that's an incredible amount of power for one person to be able to wield in a system designed to deprive you of all power, of all ability to advocate. I was actually able to get the parole. I paid everything off in advance. I paid like 3 months of rent in advance. And all of that. And I moved into one of these group housing situations. And you probably think because it's a group housing situation and a program, it's very affordable. I was paying per month what my rent is almost now for my own place, because I've since long ago, very quickly, I got my shit in order and I got my own place and I moved out of that area. I wanted to relocate away from it. Yeah. I'm now in a different area, different city.
So in other words, money, 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 test, 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 hoop, hoop, hoop. And we haven't even hit the one that made me say, what the flying fuck? You are required as a sex offender to pay for your own polygraph test periodically.
That's
which
right.
is
yeah.
a lie, a quote. This is a big finger quote. A quote lie quote. Detector that's such a shitty machine that you can't use it in court in any state, if I remember right. Still
you
in zero
state. You
can't
use it in any state
all.
For sure. It's but, not admissible, but they use it simply as a, they say they use it as a mechanism to ensure the integrity of your supervision, that you're actually complying with the conditions. But I've noticed that they only use it for people that have any sexually related based offense. And I have literally the least sexually based of the sexually related offenses. Okay. Yeah. But I'm still required to follow by all of the rules that they utilize for people that have an offense that has been classified as a sexually related offense. They use these, but the reality is a lot of times they use them just to send you back. I actually have my first one coming up soon, and I'm a little nervous about it just because of everything like I've heard about polygraphs and like how they can get like false reads because of nervousness or anxiety. But also like, I'm not really nervous about it because I've kind of like been explained the process.
Like if for some reason you didn't eat breakfast or they ask you a question that brings to mind a movie you saw that then makes you say, wait, don't think about that. You could literally have the same. This is why you can't use that garbage in court. You're nervous when you go in there, you're on parole. And you told a story in one of your other recent stories that led to the polygraph thing that says you're in a grocery store. Where the fuck else are you supposed to get food? You're getting cereal or whatever. A little kid and their mom walk by and say hi and you talk to them for 12 seconds. And then you say, nice to meet you. You fist bump them and they walk away and you immediately start fucking panicking. Because you're supposed to. You better fucking panic. You're calling your PO. You can't get a response. You're really worried that you're going to get violated because some people fucking talk to you.
That is tough. So what they tell us, and I want to be clear, while all cops are bastards, I actually have a good PO. My PO is both of the POs that I've had since I've been out. The lady that I had, I won't say their names. The lady that I had and the gentleman that I have now, that was the thing I was the single-handedly, more so than housing, more than so how I'm going to feed myself, any of that stuff. I was most worried that I was going to end up with POs who didn't want to see me do well. But I think the area that I chose to resettle in, both areas, they are a kind of small old town, you know, like, you know, kind of small town feel. But out here, I don't know what it is. It's just they just want to do their job. Don't fuck up and they're not going to fuck with you. And I appreciate that. I really do. And they tell me all the time that they see my progress notes from my classes and they see that I'm participating and they see that I'm doing all my assignments and I do all my check-ins. I pay all my stuff on time. And they see that I work basically three jobs because I work in a manufacturer, then I do journalism, and then I've been doing all of these speaking events and advocacy events. And I'm in the process of trying to start my own small business, which is not going well. So
it's hard.
It is hard. So they see the efforts that I'm making and they see that I'm very serious because like I was out with, and within a month, I had bought a whole brand new body. I had got a car, brand new car, 2024.
Oh, it was fun until you crashed it. It was so fun to watch that. And that's what I meant earlier.
I have a 2024 now because I crashed the first car.
Cool. But then the magic, like that first, when a person gets out that you see has sort of that bump start, oh, it feels so good as somebody that gives a fuck about them to see that you're not immediately in the shitter. I have 1 out of 5 students that gets out and disappears on the streets and I can't find them. And I'm like, God damn it. How did we not at least grab them? So that was a fun journey to watch you on as you got to rebecome yourself. Like I mentioned earlier, you're wearing clothes. How nice is that?
The last 3 times we talked, and you were wearing the same hair. Remember, my hair was different. You see how like my hair now?
Yeah, all of it. Yep. And I'm not on Twitter anymore because it's awful.
I'm my full self. Right. And that's incredible. It's such a blessing. And I think, like you just said, I think all the time about the people that their reentry in no way resembles mine. And my heart hurts from that because I feel like everybody should have an opportunity for a solid, safe, secure reentry that is meaningful. And, you know, my situation could have been completely different. Yes, I got a lot of blessings. I got a lot of actions by good-hearted people who wanted to help me prepare, but I put in the work because I was terrified of having a situation opposite of what it is right now. And so I did everything that I could from that cell and my little contraband cell phone device to pre-pave and pre-smooth the path for myself. But even then, there's a degree of privilege because how did I get the money to get the cell phone? And then, you know, all that stuff like that. And how did I get to
somebody read some Sam Harris.
Exactly. So, you know, there is, I did read it. It's good. So I think about that situation a lot. I do have some worry about the polygraph and stuff like that, but not significantly because I know I'm not doing anything wrong. Right. I don't break any laws, but I remember that day because I was still freshly out. I had been out for like 3 weeks, I think. And it was actually the week before I was going to have all that plastic surgery I had done, because when I got out, I was like, new body, new bitch.
You look good.
Yeah, I had all types of work done. This body has seen, to quote, what's her name? Joan Rivers. This body has seen more knives than a Benihana steakhouse.
You wear it well.
Thank you so much. It only cost me 20 grand.
I love that until recently, it seems like you've gotten busy, which is another thing we're thinking about. We get out of prison and often we realize, no wonder I was making so much fruit in there. There is jack shit to do and you tapped into something that gave you an outlet. Now you're in the world and you are being ground to fucking shreds. Like, you are required to go work. You've talked about this in another recent article. Choose any job you want and you actually get 3 or 4 jobs and they're like, oh, you can't work at those ones that have insurance and pay a good salary. You can work at fucking Taco Bell. You can work at 4 different Taco Bells. And like, how you actually manage like to do better than that by moving up to one of the other options. And you, I don't know how you described it earlier in this convo, but like, I'm just miserable all the time, but that's what we're supposed to do as Americans for the next 16 years, whatever you said, 5 years of parole and probation. It's more of that shit that's like, especially for those of us who've had drug problems, what the fuck? Why do you have to put us in that situation?
The reality is I've had to accept that some parts of my dreams, I just have to give them up. They're still beautiful.
Oh, whatever. Look at you. What parts of your dreams?
Let me explain. Being able to accept that something remains a dream doesn't make it less beautiful either. I want to preface with that. And my dreams still bring me comfort, even in the midst of the knowledge that some of them I will not be able to actualize. And that's the reality, because I actually have a decent jobs in terms of pay and benefit. Like, I make $18 an hour really isn't shit, especially with the cost of living, how eggs cost. But I make $18 an hour, which compared to minimum wage is good. I have medical and dental and vision, but I hate my job. My job is so crushing. I only work 4 days at my job, and that's enough. By the time I'm done Thursday evening, I feel drained. And I spend the rest of the weekend trying to refill my cup so that I can go back in the next week and do it again.
You sound American.
Because I work in a factory in quality control. So I spend my days doing manual labor, picking up pallets full of tile.
Something though that's related to this, because I don't want to drag this into an unlistenable length, but I was wondering about this. You've got this theology, this doctorate in theology. Have you found, you've got 2 strikes against you, depending on, well, that's kind of what I'm wondering about. Are you have no receptiveness in the education. You're a fucking teacher. I mean, like, I listen to podcasts you do, and I texted you before this and was like, God damn, that was a good show. In fact, since I don't do advertisements, I'll give a shout out. Go listen if you want more and better and shorter and much more well contained, because they didn't babble. The Amplified Voices, is that what it's called? Amplified Voices?
Yeah, Amplified Voices.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, which by the time you listen to this, who knows how long ago it'll be, but they did a See Dreams episode that's on YouTube and on all your podcatchers that was incredible. And in it, you do it with me too, so it's not like it's me that brings it out of you. It's who you are. But you snap into this fucking teacher mode. I call it preaching, where if you've ever preached, it actually feels very similar, where after it, you're like, what the fuck just happened? Like, the gear catches and all of these things line up and you realize, oh, those 8 books I've read over the last 20 years do all line up. And I did learn that shit. And it's powerful, the way you can talk about power, oppression, privilege, intersectionality. We didn't get much into how prison works for trans people, but your roommate that walked in was a man, which in and of itself, if we would have been doing a video podcast, would have made our listeners be like,
What the fuck
is going on here? Right. And I talked to him for a few. He was a great guy. But imagine being a trans woman who is in prison and that's the prison you're in. And it's not like you just get thrown into any prison. But there's something about that that is like, our system is definitely not to the point where we're going to stop fixing it. We've got a lot of work left to do. So it's annoying to me. You can't get in there. You should have classes you're teaching.
So this is the thing is, most places have background checks. I've lost some good jobs that I've interviewed for. I was one of the last candidates that was narrowed down for a good job with Motlick and Associates as a paralegal, because among other things, you know, I'm a certified paralegal. Certificated paralegal. Finally, when they got to the point that they ran the background check, I was disqualified. And that's been an experience with a lot of jobs. I recently interviewed for, I was literally, they told me beforehand, the only candidate for a bilingual supervisor position. And then I got this polite phone call telling me they chose to move in a different direction.
But I think I'm asking a different question. When you thought about those 2 jobs, to make sure I'm on the right page, do you think that those would be jobs that would be so fulfilling at the end of the day? Not no, once in a while. But how about teaching?
No, I'm just trying to show you a trend that
well,
I
have
already
you tried perceived. Though? I mean, have you found no reception at the? Have you applied to some academic positions just to see if you could get an adjunct position?
No, and the reason why is number one, I have a seminary degree, so a lot of mainstream like colleges and universities, they look down on seminary degrees if you haven't gotten your doctorate.
Seminary colleges don't, though.
No, but also I'm a transsexual, so that really limits the
so
field.
Fucking what they gave.
It limits the field of colleges that were willing to take me, but also seminary jobs are much like college or university positions. They're not many open and they're very, very hard to get. But on top of that, there were actually restrictions about me working in a college or a seminary. And most seminaries are also set up to be churches because they have chapels. And therefore, I cannot work in any paid position or volunteer in any position that could technically generate money for a church. If I could, I would just go pastor. But which I'm qualified to pastor, but I do not see myself as pastor. I see myself as a theologian and historian.
Yes, you do a lot more than that. Like, I think you'd be boxed in. You can still offer spiritual guidance to people.
Yeah, no, for sure. Path,
but like, I think you got about 13 other subjects you need to put on the agenda.
But what I am doing, and I'm actually doing it for free because it's a small thing. There's a small prison ministry out of my old seminary. From Madison Heights, Virginia. I do a little bit of theology tutoring for them via Zoom. So that's doesn't technically break my regulations, but yeah, in a lot of ways, my doctorate is useless because I can't, I mean, and it's crazy because I work with people and like, there's just one lady who has a nasty attitude with everybody, but she particularly hates me and I don't give a fuck. I hope she gags on it. She, I was thinking the other day, she was copping this attitude. I was asking her very nicely because I was trying to get something to do my job. And I'm the quality control inspector, but she pushes back at everybody. But I was sitting here thinking, I was like, I've done all this shit. I am a freaking writing fellow for Logics at Columbia University. Yeah. I have won scholarships and been acknowledged as a scholar. I have a fucking doctorate. And here I am working in this fucking warehouse with this bitch who doesn't know a first thing about me, but she has the audacity to try to ruin this chipper Tuesday morning with this badass attitude.
I like, can't wait to read your book. Honestly, a different side note I wanted to make sure I at least brought up with you before we end, but let's not go there yet. But like, you know how to swing an adjective. I don't know how else to say that, but like, you know how to drop a sentence that makes the listener go, what the fuck did she say?
This chipper Tuesday morning. I've always wanted to be an advocate and a teacher and I've always wanted that. That's not even, but I just, 19-year-old me would be, right. Her little mind would be so blown away.
35-year-old me's mind was like, no fucking way you could stand in front of a classroom and teach. So don't even try to trick yourself. I just rolled more sevens. Like, I wish I could take credit for it, but I read Sam Harris's work too. So I'm like, oh, every time somebody else would have been like, I don't want to do this. And I was like, I do. What was it that I chose to want to do? No, it just fucking felt good. And I'm a junkie. So I was like, well, give me the thing that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
I just see that. And you, like, you notice too, you see that. Especially as addicted people, one of the things we both noticed is patching that and learning and reading the right book that makes you really engage. It lets you walk away with actually a little bit of what we got from drugs: fulfillment, contentment, connection, a new experience, exploration. And man, I see you. I just, like, in my mind's eye, I see you in front of a prison class writing on a whiteboard, and I'm like,
wow,
get there already.
That's it's
not,
crazy.
Not that I you mean, can just get there, but
I would love that. The reality is that if I was any other type of class of felon, the potentiality for me would be so much more open and so much more awesome, because I see so many people come from the carceral space and transfer into teaching and writing and public policy. But the reality is that the culture as it's set up now, and more importantly, the laws as they're set up right now, anybody that is in my position that has convictions for sexual-related offenses, it's almost impossible. But even if I wanted to, like, for example, there was a job open at the Southern Center for Human Rights that I was totally qualified for, but I couldn't even waste my time doing the application, because before I do that, I always run the address of the place that I want to work to check it for compliance. And of course, with it being in downtown Atlanta, there was like a church, a parochial school, a park across the street. So it's like, not even considering the qualifications, not even considering the fact of the stigma or my criminal record, there are literal physical, in terms of legislation, laws in place right now that just obliterate my opportunities for employment. I'm trying to figure out the next steps forward for how to create some financial independence for myself, but also to just create a life that I'm happy with, you know, that I feel fulfilled by. I don't know why that was so difficult. I haven't figured out the exact road path yet. I'm working on it and I'm trying to do more talks and stuff like that.
I hear you. This is the human condition. It matters not where you are. You never feel power when you have it. You always feel it when somebody above you has it and you feel like you're supposed to be in that place. And it never fucking ends. You never will feel like a success unless you let yourself realize nobody does. And then we all get to feel like free will doesn't exist and we're successful.
100%. You're so right about that. And I think that is another reason why I really try to practice that gratitude and just be aware and present in the facts of how far I've come and how things have changed and improved. And while there may be some doors that are closed to me, there are other doors. I just have to find the doors and get them open. I'm afraid I'm going to pour all this time into this book that I could be using for paid writing assignments and that the book isn't going to go anywhere because let's be honest, we want to tell our stories in our books, but we want some damn revenue too.
As a foundation, just assume it won't. I think your goal with the book is going to be to help people in about 10,000 different situations that will read two chapters and go, holy fuck, somebody's been through this. It's the same experience I get when a student in prison looks and goes like, holy shit, I could do that. And then I notice by the end of the semester, they've actually embodied something is different about them. They've realized I couldn't get out and be a manager at Taco Bell. And that's what I'm working for. You're saying I could literally make my life into a lot of things that I didn't think were possible. And even some of the stuff we talked about today, like, holy fuck, it's just beautiful. I mean, it's beautifully tragic. It's the sort of thing that I'm like, well, make the book already. So Holly, you make your money with the movie. And my story isn't really movie worthy, maybe a boring Netflix two series, some crappy, right? Like exaggerated.
What do you think I should write? You think I should write like a memoir, like a life story type of book?
Yeah, but I think it's got to have. So the whole thing my editors have said since I was in grad school was, yes, but what's the point? So yeah, the memoir is what hooks them, but to make sure it actually has that extra hook, what's the point? We've talked about some of what seems to already be your point. You've talked about how your brain thought when you were 19 and how this is something most people don't agree with until you really unpack it. So as one example, if you went back in time and were in that body again, would you make a separate decision, a different decision when you were about to get charged with pimping and pandering that 17-year-old?
I would hope that I would.
But your answer was actually no. I've heard you talk about it and you're like, there's no space to make a separate decision. I didn't feel the way I feel now. Yeah. And the only reason I didn't wasn't because I filled out a survey before I was born and said, bad person at 19. No, it was all experience and genetics, and lucky for fucking me, since then I've encountered some things and here's what I encountered. And I think in doing that, you give people who are in prison, we're told, we've talked about it. Our first episode was called I Ain't Shit Syndrome that you and
that's
I did.
That's right, yeah.
We talked about like, that's what it means to be charged with a crime. It means every fucking buddy in the whole country thinks you are such a piece of shit. We are taking you before people will pay to stand over you and tell you you might have to be locked up. How the fuck are you supposed to embody that? You got two choices. Fuck the world, which most of us embrace to some degree, or get a cell phone in here, start writing papers, put some levers to the system of power, try to make things just a little bit better. I don't know how you're going to put it together because I'm not you and I don't want to.
I don't either.
It's going to be a good fucking book.
I don't either. I promise it is on my plans. But I think right now I'm still trying to, you know, stabilize and equalize a little bit more. I have having a lot of things fall at me at one time because I owe the IRS apparently for all the money I generated from my journalism. So we've got a tax person that's helping us with that. And I'm trying to handle that. And then I've got some student loan debts that I'm still paying off. And I'm trying to figure out things. And also, I'm still only 2 months into my marriage. So and my husband is going through the immigration process. So it's been a struggle to get him settled in, and he's learning English.
That was C Dreams. And you can find links to all her work on X, Twitter, whatever you call it now, or at Filter Magazine, a magazine I'm a big advocate of. Until next time, I'm Ben Boyce.